Welcome to CYC Podcast Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 126. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. Today I'm continuing a conversation that we started last month about gender-based violence and sexually predatory behavior. After our March episode, we received a lot of very thoughtful, helpful, and critically insightful feedback. I want to thank everyone who took the time to reach out to us, to post comments on Facebook, and some who very, very generously engaged in conversation with me personally. I also encourage people to look at the Facebook posting by Nancy Marshall, who did a really instructive critique of the conversation that I had. And I think there's a lot to learn from what she wrote, and I know that I learned a lot. So please take the time to read that. In response to the interview, we at CYC Podcast made a commitment to continue speaking about this topic, and we're doing that today. After consulting with a variety of people, I decided to reach out to White Ribbon, who agreed to come on the podcast. I contacted White Ribbon partly because they're an organization that was started by men and focuses on men. And we at CYC Podcast thought it was important to continue to address perceptions of men regarding gender-based violence, given that the vast, vast majority of such violence is committed by men. However, after reaching out to White Ribbon and having a conversation with their bilingual program manager, Véronique Church-Duplessis, we decided to have a conversation with Véronique, who identifies as a woman. Hello, Véronique, and thank you for joining me today.
Hello, thank you for having us.
I'm really appreciative and grateful that you were able to have this conversation and have this conversation so quickly. Just to contextualize a little bit, maybe you could start by telling us what the White Ribbon is?
Yes, of course. So White Ribbon is an organization that was started in 1991 after the Montreal Massacre. So for those of you who might not be familiar with the Montreal Massacre, in 1989, a man who blamed feminists for not being admitted to an engineering school and other aspects of his life that weren't going according to his wishes, went to the École Polytechnique in Montreal, and he ended up murdering 14 women there. After that, a number of men, including Jack Layton and Michael Kaufman, thought that it was important for men to start having conversations amongst themselves and with other men about their role to prevent violence against women, and the fact that men had a responsibility to end violence against women and girls, and it started as a grassroots movement and asking men to take a pledge, and the pledge was to never commit, condone, or remain silent about violence against women and girls.
Maybe I should let people know that I went to some of the very, very first meetings back in Toronto, which tells people how old I am. But and it was really it was an important education for me around White Ribbon and gender-based violence and continued my own process of becoming aware. So it's amazing, I think, that the organization still exists, and as far, I mean, we met, you know, in a small room with, you know, about 15 or 20 of us back then. So I think it's great. When I went looking for someone to come on the program, I was consciously looking for a male-identifying person. And as I said in the introduction, and I wanted to continue the conversation with another man because I didn't want to leave the responsibility of teaching men about gender-based violence to women. It seemed a bit akin to me as I'm a white person asking people of color to teach me about racism. And I think I need to make the effort to learn and to learn from other white people in the case of racism and other men in the case of gender-based violence. And when I spoke with you, I brought this up, and your response was quite useful for me in my own thinking, and it's partly the reason I'm speaking with you today. Could you share with the audience some of what you spoke about when we had that conversation on the phone?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that we talked about the idea that it is absolutely true that the burden of educating men about gender-based violence and violence against women and the work for gender equality shouldn't be a burden for women. It shouldn't be on them to educate men on this topic at all times, at their convenience and all of that. But one of the dangers of having conversations exclusively with male-identified folks is that eventually you run the risk of marginalizing and sidelining women's voices and undermining their authority when it comes to talking about gender-based violence and healthy gender norms and healthy masculinities. So I think that we need to find a balance here. Women should be allowed and encouraged to speak about their own experiences of violence and discrimination since they do have daily experiences and they're quite familiar with the topic. When they're open to sharing those experiences, I think that we need to make room and listen to them and hear what they're saying. On the other hand, we shouldn't be imposing on them and requesting them to share their experiences, share their time, repeat themselves. They shouldn't be asked to answer any question at any time, and there shouldn't be this sense of entitlement that you are, as a male-identified person, you are entitled to ask any question or engage in any debate with a woman about discrimination and gender-based violence. So women should be free to do so on their own time and on their own terms. And when women are open to doing that, I think that male-identified individuals can make an effort to listen. But we do need to hear from men on this issue as well, and we would like to encourage here at White Ribbon, we like to encourage more men to become allies and partners in this journey for gender equality. And the way to do that in a responsible, accountable way is by the same thing we do, the same thing I do as a white person when it comes to issues of racial discrimination, is amplifying the voices of those who have those experiences of discrimination, giving them some space to share their stories, believing them and supporting them, but that has to be done in a way that is accountable to the person and responsible to the person who is sharing that story. And men have a place in this conversation as well, and in terms of the fact that they are in a better position oftentimes to hold other men accountable when they express comments or when they make jokes that are sexist or homophobic or transphobic. So basically, in some male-dominated space, it is likely or possible that men will hear comments like that belittle women and LGBTQ folks, and there is a place for them to step in and mention that this type of language and these ideas are just not acceptable. And there's another point to this, is that we need to remember that in this conversation, in conversations about discrimination, gender discrimination, and gender-based violence, we also need to make space for the voices of members of the LGBTQ community who have their own experiences, and I can't speak for them, but that I can echo and amplify what they're saying, but we should make an effort to also reach out to those communities and hear what they have to say and what they need.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And we've had a variety of conversations over the years with different folks from the LGB community, although not so much the bisexual community, and certainly we've had several conversations with trans folks over the years, and really, really important. I think, you know, identifying how those things overlap, how gender-based violence also gets extended into other communities of gender-divergent communities, and then into sexuality as well. Mm-hmm. I also appreciate your distinction between, you know, demanding that women respond anytime I have a question, and demanding that I listen when there is an opportunity to learn. I think that's a nice distinction, and it's helpful for me. The interview today, as I said in the introduction, really follows up from last month, And as I said in the introduction, we received a lot of really helpful and generous feedback. Some people might be wondering why we're having another conversation right away about this topic, you know, a very similar conversation. And well, let me say why do you think it's so important that we continue to have conversations about responding to gender-based violence?
Well, it's such a complicated and pervasive issue that we can't think that one conversation will solve all of our problems here and we're done with it and we can move on. And this is so pervasive and it was taboo for so long that now that there is an opportunity to talk about it and that people are more willing to listen and to show some openness to the topic, I think that we should capitalize on that moment. I think that we're living in a very interesting cultural moment here. And we have some preliminary discussions about it in Canada in 2012 with the whole Gomeshi trial and all of that. But the conversation died down a bit. But what we've seen, at least at White Ribbon and in other community organizations since the fall and the start of the Me Too movement, is that this conversation has been brought to the forefront again, and it is not really dying down. And in the first part of that conversation had been about disclosing experiences of sexual violence and highlighting how pervasive the problem is and all the barriers that stood in the way of women and other survivors coming forward and sharing their experiences. But what we're seeing now that we have time to process all of those disclosures and those issues is and a willingness and a desire to move the conversation further beyond just hearing about how pervasive it is and looking at solutions. So how do we move this forward? How can we start fixing that issue in our society? And we're talking about changing the culture here, so it's not going to be fixed easily. Changing behaviors and attitudes and culture, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of effort, it takes a lot of meaningful, in-depth conversations that are followed by actions and behavioral changes, and people have to make concerted efforts to follow up and see this through. And as parents and educators and individuals who work with youth, we also have a duty and to remember that sexual violence does affect young people. Young women in their teens and early adulthood are more likely to be the victim of sexual violence than adult women. So we can't pretend that this is not happening to the young people that we're serving. And if we're not talking about it openly and if we're not taking into account that the people we're serving are likely to have experienced sexual violence, we're not going to help them. We're doing a disservice to them, and we're not going to make any progress in terms of prevention and changing the culture here.
Absolutely. We'll talk about some statistics shortly, but many, many women have experienced gender-based violence, and I statistically speaking, that becomes even more prevalent when you start to talk about young people who are in the child welfare, criminal justice, mental health system. That those numbers just jump. So, you know, the people that we as child and youth care practitioners work with, are very, very likely. I mean, I sort of start with the assumption that chances are this young person I've worked with, particularly women, but certainly not exclusively women, chances are this person has experienced sexual violence and certainly gender-based violence, given the nature of the structures that they work within.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Just a little bit about language here. So I've been using the term gender-based violence. You've been using the term gender-based violence. Could you give us a bit of a definition for what exactly that term means?
Mm-hmm. So gender-based violence, well, it's an umbrella term, right? It refers to any form of violence that is based on an individual's gender. So that violence is perpetrated against them because of their gender identity or their perceived gender identity. So we're talking about any violence from physical violence or sexual violence, but also psychological and economical violence. And this doesn't affect only women and girls, although they do represent the majority of victims, but members of the LGBTQ community also do experience alarming rates of gender-based violence because of questions of gender. And that term is useful, too, because it highlights that the root causes of this type of violence are the same, whether you are female-identifying or if you're a member of the LGBTQ community. So all of that is rooted in patriarchy, thousands of years of a cultural and social system telling women and non-cisgender heterosexual men that they are lesser than cisgender heterosexual men, basically. And the very rigid gender norms and expectations that go with a patriarchal system and that influence our culture and society. So those root causes of gender-based violence are the same when you look at the victims of that type of violence.
Absolutely. And I think there's also, it's quite... Even for straight cis men, it's quite limiting, right? I mean, there's young boys, they're very, very rigid definitions of what it means to be male, to be a man, and how that's expressed, and so even those straight cis listeners who identify as men, it is limiting, right? It prevents men from expressing a full range of feelings and emotions and being full people.
Exactly. A lot of our work does explore that. You just put your finger on it. It's and that is connected in turn to violence. And those rigid norms do hurt everyone. I think we've made some progress in this area, but there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of freeing people from those gender expectations.
Absolutely.
And I think we can come back to that a bit more later as well.
Yeah, I know certainly when I teach a class and I look at the classroom of students in child and youth care, and I see two guys or three male identifying people and 35 female identifying people, I think it saddens me. But there you go.
Yes.
It's well documented that the vast majority of assaults, vast majority of gender-based assaults happen by men, perpetuated by men. And we were just talking about how it impacts, sort of limiting how we can express ourselves. How do you think... You use a term in our conversation, rape culture. How do you think rape culture impacts males who are explicitly victims of sexual violence?
Yes. So you rightly point out that sexual violence and gender-based violence, it's gendered. The vast majority of perpetrators are male, and the vast majority of its victims are female-identified and members of the LGBTQ community. And if you look at trans women, they have very high risks of being harassed, assaulted, or otherwise the victim of violent crime. But yes, men are also affected. So the statistics in Canada are 1 in 3 women who will be the victim of sexual violence and a form of sexual assault during their lifetimes. And sometimes we tend to forget, but in terms of male-identified victims, we're talking about 1 in 6 men across the country who will be the victim of sexual violence. Oftentimes, as you pointed out earlier in our conversation, oftentimes those men were victimized in their youth. So most of the victims have those experiences in their childhood or youth. And one of the impacts of the culture we live in, and of rape culture, is that it is incredibly difficult for male victims to come forward and disclose their experiences of sexual violence. Not in no way saying that it is easy for women. On the contrary, it's quite hard, but at least there is a bit of a conversation, especially right now, happening about women's experiences of violence, and perhaps a little less of a feeling of being alone. When it comes to male victims, there is not much conversation happening, and the isolation can seem higher than in terms of female victims. And we can also look at recent examples of men who have disclosed their experiences of sexual violence and the responses that we've seen that are frankly deplorable in a lot of ways. And that constitutes a huge barrier to coming forward and getting help and disclosing your experience. But if we look at Terry Crews, I don't know if you're familiar with Terry Crews. He's an ex-footballer. He's an actor now and has done openly identifies as a feminist, has been very active in terms of examining modern masculinity and what it means to be a man in our culture. But Terry Crews, in the wake of the Me Too movement in last November, disclosed that he had been groped at a party in Hollywood. And he came forward and explained that he hadn't disclosed the experiences at first because of his own position, his own identity as a pretty large black man, and fearing not being believed and fearing repercussions. And there's a whole layer there of racial dynamics that prevented him from disclosing. But there's also the idea that he didn't want to be ostracized. He didn't want to be laughed at for disclosing that experience of violence. And once he did, and he bravely came forward, he wasn't treated very well. He received a whole bunch of insults and threats, including some Twitter commentators who called him and gay for being assaulted by another man. So that comes up as quite a significant barrier to disclosing for men if they think that their own gender identity, that their masculinity would be called into question if they come forward and disclose that experience. And more broadly, rape culture and gender expectations do put a lot of pressure on men, and particularly young men, to behave in certain ways. Generally speaking, in our culture, there's this expectation that men are automatically want sex, that they are looking for sex, and that this is one of their prime motivator. And if we look at one recent example, Katy Perry, who kissed a contestant on American Idol. This young man was 19 years old, I believe, and he hadn't had a kiss because he wanted to wait and have a kiss that would be special with someone with whom he would feel a deep connection. And Katy Perry kissed him without his consent. And there were lots of people encouraging this behavior, pushing it on, and they completely disregarded the fact that he did not want that kiss because it wasn't seen as an option. They couldn't fathom that he wouldn't want that. And in the minds of some of the people who were there and the audience, this marked this young man's entry into manhood. He was finally becoming one of the gang. And that puts a lot of pressure on men to behave in a certain way in our society. And that's a pretty extreme example, but we see that in other areas as well, in milder forms, perhaps.
Absolutely. I mean, when I watched that video clip of Katy Perry, the thing that struck me was the celebratory nature, the hands up, the success, the conquest, yeah. Right?
Like it was a rite of passage.
Yeah,
and those need to be celebrated.
It was quite distressing to me watching that.
Yes.
Just imagining what that that young guy was going through. And this just really brings up this idea of rape culture, this sense of entitlement, mm-hmm. this sense of I can have whatever I want. What, you know, that term is sort of used these days, like so many terms, and sometimes we're not, it's a bit unclear what we mean by that. And I think that example, you know, is a small symptom of that. But when we talk about rape culture, what is it that we're talking about?
Well, first of all, rape culture is, for the most part, the culture that we live in. It refers to a culture in which the dominant ideas, our media and popular culture, and even our institutions do tend to normalize violence against women, and particularly sexual violence. So to unpack that a little bit more, it doesn't mean that every male-identified person in our culture is a perpetrator of violence, and that every female-identified or non-binary person is a victim. But it is a culture in which women and girls are largely objectified, and the extension of that is that they're seen to exist for male pleasure, particularly sexual pleasure. Rape culture also is tied to the fact that sexual violence is not often seen as a big deal. It's sometimes tolerated, or it's not called out. People kind of look away. They don't mention it. There's a culture of silence around it. If we look to Weinstein and Hollywood and all the other folks who have been held accountable finally for their behavior, you see that people knew about it, but didn't come forward. So that's part of rape culture, too, that this silence there and this unwillingness to call people out. And we also have another part of this is the fact that oftentimes victims are blamed for their own assault. Questions are such as, what were they wearing? What were they drinking? Who were they with? And all of that, and contributes to rape culture, where we're not taking the incident seriously and we're not assigning responsibility where it should be, which is solely with the perpetrator. And what we can do to move beyond that really is to start by recognizing that rape culture exists. It might be a very provocative term, but I think it's a useful concept to describe all of the phenomena that I've just mentioned. And moving from there, we can start by looking at the ways women are represented in the media, in our culture, and in advertising, and make a concerted effort to stop objectifying women and girls and restore their full humanity, and stop seeing them as prizes to be won, and instead have real conversations about consent and what a consent culture would look like, right? A consent culture would be a culture in which asking permission for anything, even if it's not sexual, is the norm. So it's about treating others with respect and respecting boundaries.
So we're at about 25 minutes into our conversation, and we're about a third through the questions that we've developed. So I would like to propose something, if you're willing. I would like to end this month's episode here, and then I would like to for you and I to continue on the conversation. And what I'll do, rather than waiting a full month to continue the conversation, what I'll do is I'll post the next episode next week, which will be the first week of May. Are you okay to do that? Do you have time to do that, Véronique?
Absolutely. It's a complex topic, and I think it deserves to be treated in depth and take the time to be addressed in a meaningful way.
Absolutely. Well, thank you then. We'll close this particular episode, and I want to thank you so much for starting this. And what we're gonna talk about now, we're gonna move into really is, how do we develop consent culture? What does that look like? How do we address these things on a structural and a practical way? Is where we're gonna go in the next part of this conversation. So thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to the rest of our conversation right now and next week.
Perfect. That sounds great to me, and thank you for having us. Delighted to be part of this conversation and looking forward to keeping it going next week.
Excellent. And for those of you who want more information about White Ribbon, we will post links on the podcast page, and at the end of the second interview, we'll also talk a little bit more about where you can find out more information about White Ribbon.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.